Hey y'all, welcome to Holy Coitus, a community of hoes, H-E-A-U-X. We are humans who engage in consensual coitus, are kind to ourselves and partners, creative, fully embodied, unapologetic, powerful, and free. My mission is to encourage everybody and everyone to claim or reclaim their sexual agency and voice, regardless of what parts you were born with or changed, where you live, what you did in the past, what you learned in the past, what you plan to do in the future. Whether you've had zero sex partners or countless a week, your hoe story is welcome here. You are welcome here. Hey, hey, y'all. Welcome to my corner of the world. My name is Janaea, and I'm so glad you found me and my podcast, Holy Coitus. This is where I share and chat with people about their hoe stories, their body stories, their views on themselves and how they've changed over the years. And also, like, what they're doing now with their bodies and their minds, and as it pertains to gender and sexuality and having sex or not having sex or wherever they find themselves. Today's guest, he is in Germany. His name is Patrick, and you can find him on Instagram at secure_not_pure, and that is secure_not_pure. We chat today about his journey in white evangelical church, and now he is in a beautiful family structure and is polyamorous and has a baby on the way. So exciting, y'all. All right. If you yourself want to share your story, you are always welcome to do so. Come chat with me about that. You can do so anonymously if you so choose, and many people have done so. My Instagram is Holy Coitus, and that is HEAUXLYCOITUS. And you can find other host stories, other body stories there. Some of my little rants and ravings about me trying to date as a 35-year-old that was a virgin until 31. And then also just, you know, some of my observations and such. And so come support my work, follow me, like my podcast, all the things, tell your friends, and listen to other episodes. Each one is incredible. Without further ado, y'all, this is my conversation with Patrick. Enjoy.
All right.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to my little corner of the world, Holy Coitus. Today, I have a guest. Their name is Secure Not Pure. So, welcome. How are you doing today?
Hi. You can actually call me Patrick.
Hello, Patrick. Okay. Wonderful. And what is your gender pronoun preferences? What do you, which ones do you prefer?
He, him.
He, him. Wonderful. Yeah. Nice to meet you. So let's start at the beginning. I like to ask each of my guests the same beginning question, which is who and or what taught you about sex in your body? And what were some of those initial lessons that you learned way back when?
Oh, man. Way back when. I think I learned that it's something you don't really talk about. Hmm. And that's something you should be very, very ashamed of to begin with. Hmm. Yeah, just to stay there for a moment.
Sounds is that good. What you... Yeah, like, yeah. I, in some regards, I have the same lessons. And so I understand. And so can you talk about, like, your family dynamic when you grew up? So you are bicultural or...
Yeah.
I don't know if you call it bi-ethnic or multi-ethnic. So can you talk about, like, where your parents came from and where did you grow up? Yes.
Yeah, I would say I'm maybe bicultural, mm-hmm. Definitely bilingual. So I was born in 1981, which makes me 41 years old at this point in time. I was born and grew up in Germany, my mom being an American expat, and my dad is actually from Germany. As a young man, he toured the United States in a Volkswagen Beetle, and that's where he met my mom, actually. And it had something to do with, I don't really know the story that well, but they were singing in a church somehow, in a church choir or something at some point. And so yeah, music and religion and the English language and culture, American language and culture have always dominated my life, I would say. So my mom came over to Germany in the 1970s. They got married. They had me. And my mom, I guess, had a hard time learning German and connecting with people. I mean, that's a big thing for you right now as well, I guess. So we were living in a very small town where there simply were not many, Americans or even English-speaking people around. So what they did back then was basically to reach out to any English-speaking people they could find. And the closest living English-speaking people they could find, I guess, happened to be a missionary pastor, a guy from the States, and his wife. And so that's how we then, in the long run, became a rather evangelical American family living in the middle of Germany, even though, well, they had been Catholic, both of them, earlier. Maybe I should say something about Germany. I don't know if Germany is featured that much.
You are my first German podcast person. I don't know if you want to talk about it quite yet, but one of the questions that I will eventually ask you is because of the work that you do on your podcast, not podcast, but on your platform on Instagram, what evangelical looks like outside of the American context. So I want to know about Germany, yes, and also evangelicalism outside of white Americanism. Yes. So.
It's very, very diverse. It's very, very different. You find almost anything. I would say that, well, I can only speak from my perspective. Probably the churches that I've seen in Germany, the places that I've gone to, they were very much looking towards the US. Culturally and for inspiration, and even the songs, they're frequently just translated US American songs. I mean, they were back then, the 1980s, early 1990s, whenever that was that we got into that culture. And it's very, very, very small. It tends to be, I mean, I can only say this for Germany right now. Germany basically, this is a little bit of a cliche, but it's true. Germany is just very, very secular. In comparison, there's hardly any religious people that you just and it, even the religious people don't really talk about it, so they just keep it to themselves. And we have two big mainline churches, which is of course the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Protestant Church. Anything else is a very, very small minority, and you're basically seen as an outcast if you're evangelical, Pentecostal, or anything like that. Non-denominational stuff like that doesn't really even exist in Germany. So, yes, there is kind of a tradition, but it's really small. You really have to look for it. And the world is just really, really small. The evangelical world in Germany is really small. Like everyone knows each other, and it's always the same people at at the conferences or whatever. So you're seen as an extremist. You're seen as a fanatic, basically, if you're not in one of the very, very old, huge mainline churches, or just a secular person with no religious affiliation at all. So yeah, it's a very, very small minority in Germany, I would say.
That is wild to me. So, in an everyday context, in America, our morality and our how we decide what's okay and not okay, is based on a puritanical understanding of people and the world and such. And so, in a very secular society, what is the conversation like with people who are non-religious, secular? And they and them determining okay, this is okay to do, this is not okay to do. How are people doing this?
Yeah, that's hard for me to answer. I wasn't really expecting it to go this way.
I wasn't.
So,
I'm so sorry. And then we could go back to
no,
your
it's okay.
question. Yeah.
Let me improvise. I guess. I mean, you can cut out all my ums and
No, I love it. That's,
no, okay.
yes, keep them in.
My hesitation markers. There was one. It's based on common sense more than anything else. It's this ingrained culture, I guess. Just you do it like that. I would say that you probably don't have as many unhealthy things that can be kept up for such a long time as they can if you're basing everything on a biblical verse or something like that. So stuff like, I don't know, not letting women preach or something like that can only really be upheld if you are coming from a very sort of literalist understanding of the Bible or something like that. As soon as you get, it's more based on either, well, it's a mixture of how things always were, and that's why we do it that way. We just never thought about it differently. And just common sense. Oh yeah, well, if you want to do it like that, well, okay. If it's not hurting anybody, or I don't know. I think that's where most people would say morality comes from
That
then.
is fascinating. Since I'm here in China, this is the first time I've traveled all over, which I'm super grateful for. And this is the first country where I've lived, one, and two, out like there is very little religious anything here. Debatably, the government is the religion, the government is the God, the CCP. I mean, it's a debate. But I've been to exactly one church service in my last 4 years of living here, and I said absolutely never again because it was just bizarre. And people, like, it's been fascinating to me that people are still, it seems so cliche, but people are just living their lives, but they just don't go to church and they don't think about God or they don't think about religious things. It's wild to me. And the like people have the same problems at the same proportions as people that do go to church. And so like humanity is the same whether you go to a religious place or you don't. And that has blown my mind. And it's made me think about a whole lot of things since being here for sure. Yes. Oh.
Yeah, it sounds very similar, actually, to how things are in Germany.
Oh, okay, going back to your thing. So, you were born there, and you found yourself because of the missionary connection with the English language, and you were pushed or you were assimilated into, I don't know the word. So yes, that's where we left off.
Yeah, that's true. So I just to maybe connect that a little bit more. I think I was the one in our family who wanted to actually go back there, to wanted to go to that church where the people were playing guitar and doing lively stuff as opposed to church organs or whatever. which see, you know, churches in Germany in general, they just seem very like dusty and old fashioned, and it's only old people there, and you have this organ playing. It's really cool. I mean, to an outsider, it's like, wow, this is cool. This is old. Look at all these old statues and stuff. But really, my feeling as a child was that it's far away. God is far away, and there's this weird priest and this weird smell and these weird candles, and they say weird things in a weird tone of voice. Singing more than talking. During church service, I mean, even the stuff that they should be saying, they're singing because it's a liturgy, you know. And that's so far removed, and I felt so, I don't know, as an early teen or whatever, I felt so alive in this other more sort of American evangelical based church. I mean, even the fact that there are missionaries, right, coming from America, from that kind of culture to Germany, because apparently we need missionaries because, you know, the churches are quote unquote dead, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of that shows you where it's going. But anyway, yeah, my childhood experience. I was thinking about this a little bit. I think I was very disembodied at the time. Mm-hmm. And not connected to myself. Today I know that I have what is called a fearful avoidant attachment style, which means I tend to avoid direct confrontations. For the longest time, I had no access to my own emotions. I tend to freeze or to stonewall when something triggers me, when something goes wrong personally. I must have had some kind of a developmental trauma back then. I, as a child, the first things I drew would be smiley faces, mm-hmm. sitting on this triangle shape, which, looking at that today, just seems to symbolize how little a feeling I had for, you know, or the body other than, you know, the face that's looking at you. So I think I spent a lot of my early years sort of in a fantasy world and in the world of my own mind. Sexuality was very rarely even talked about. I remember getting or feeling what I would call a sex negative vibe, especially from my mom. I mean, it was enough to just see, like, on TV, if someone was, I don't know, kissing or something on TV, she would say, yeah, well, now they're smooching again or something like that. So it's just it was a very, I don't know, unhealthy relationship, I guess, that she had to the whole topic of sex and her own body and sexuality. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel very embodied at all. When my own body started changing, I could not talk to them or to anybody about it. So that made me, I guess, lonely. And I also started developing some, I think, very unhealthy or a very unhealthy mindset, like about my own body, what I should and should not be doing. So that basically sums up my earliest experiences with faith, but also sexuality.
Yeah, for sure.
I guess. Yeah. So my formative years were then spent in evangelical Christianity, as I would call it, in the 1990s, when I was a teenager, which was also the apex of purity culture and the True Love Waits movement. And we didn't really have that in Germany, because I said it's secular. Mm-hmm. If you're a church person, you're a mainline church person singing songs that are 500 years old, and it's not really connected to anything else in your life. But of course, there is this really, really small niche of evangelicalism in Germany, which is where I was. And so, yes, I actually still have the True Love Waits Bible. I listened to contemporary Christian music. I think I would have loved Nirvana, but I didn't allow myself that. I listened to DC Talk's Jesus Freak instead. a lot of American music, actually. Yep. 'Cause Germany doesn't really have a lot of contemporary Christian music. Mm-hmm. So that A True Love Waits Bible I got for my baptism when I was 15. I actually had a breakaway subscription. Do you know that?
I had Brio. Oh my gosh. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Wow.
The brother and sister magazines from Focus on the Family.
Focus on the Family.
yeah. James Dobson.
So, quick side note. So, I was, I'm in a group of, Chinese people talking about random stuff. And, this one guy, he's very strange and he asks lots of questions and things. And he, for some reason, it's environmentalism and then it's Western stuff and politics. Like, he has questions for days. And he looked up gender education or something. And the website that he found was actually Focus on the Family.
Oh,
and okay. I was like, I need you to never look at this website again. Like, this is really problematic. I was like, how in the world did you find this on Chinese web's internet? Like, and he was just like, well, they had a lot of information. I was like, it's all bad. Don't read it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes. So you had Breakaway. Congratulations.
Yeah. I actually signed that Pledge for Purity thing. I don't remember if that was in the True Love Waits Bible or if that came with an issue of Breakaway or something like that. But yeah. I do know that I signed that thing.
I did too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no sex until marriage, and that they, I don't know, sent it to the U.S. with my signature on it.
Oh my gosh.
As if that absolutely meant anything. Mm. Yeah. So being in this evangelical, Pentecostal, whatever church as a teen, let me just say it was already kind of an act of rebellion against the secular culture in a way. So I always had this tendency to sort of undermine whatever the majority was doing or to go against the grain. And so in this weird little tiny evangelical culture, I found a way of being even more unique as a teenager. So I wore a lot of black. I started listening to goth, industrial, extreme metal music. I dyed my hair black. I still dye my hair black. And so that's, and wear a lot of band t-shirts. And so that's a part of that culture never really left me. And of course that confused all of the people in the tiny, tiny churches where I was. So, I don't know. I always looked for a way of becoming more unique, I guess. In terms of sexuality at the time, I just felt very uneasy, very, very insecure. I viewed myself as very unattractive. And this whole sex negativity coming from my parents meant that there was no talking, there was no conversation possible, no processing of anything that happened to me or to my body at the time. I remember at this tiny Christian teen camp, which was more like a Bible study camp, where I was, I remember sort of like praying against masturbation or something like that. And so I was in this very, very strange place where, paradoxically, from today's perspective, I was praying like crazy for a girlfriend. And at the same time, I was basically praying for my sex drive to go away. So really weird. Speaking of girlfriends, I didn't really have any noteworthy longer relationships as a teenager. The two times that I had a girlfriend, of course, we never really touched or anything, but they just really, in both cases, they moved away. They moved far away. Mm-hmm. And so then actually nobody ever really broke up with me, which is kind of interesting. I had, as a teenager, I think I had a very, very strong libido. I didn't know what to do with it. I felt a very strong shame, basically, about everything. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a struggle. My faith at the time, also very, very immature. I guess I was, from today's perspective, I would say fundamentalist or fundamentalistish. I don't know. Probably had some very strong views on homosexuality and abortion and all of that, which I, of course, was just taking in from the culture around me. I was very much into things like the Book of Revelation because of the symbolism and because it's so nerdy. And at the same time, I was sort of leaning towards this literalism as well. So kind of like, wow, the end of the world. And that was my thing. Also because it has nothing to do with reality, I guess. So faith was this completely different dream world. And my own body was more like a problem. I don't know. So that's my inner world as a teenager.
So many things resonate. So many things resonate with that part of your story that I hear a lot with other guests during their adolescence, the shame piece, and also the balance between like high libido and this is bad, and so I can't have this, and praying like opposite prayers, like you were saying, you know, pray for a girlfriend, but then praying sex drive goes away, because, and then just being stuck in the middle and having that dissonance, and that's really hard. That is really hard. Yeah.
Yeah. So, should I just fast forward a little bit?
Absolutely.
I met my future wife at 19. We were both into goth stuff. We both came from this sort of evangelical background, even though hers was a little bit different. Was a bit more German based, pietism, if that says anything to you. Mm-hmm. So Brüdergemeinde sort of based. I don't even know what that would be in English, and much less charismatic, but still very evangelical, sex negative upbringing. Also born the same year as me, and we met at a concert, actually, where this Christian dark music band was playing. And then so we met at 19. We got married at 21, of course. Very early from today's perspective. Mm. And basically, I think it was highly motivated by wanting to just end the struggle and finally being allowed to have sex, basically.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, I think I felt coerced into an early marriage, even though I wouldn't have said that at the time. But yeah, I certainly felt very immature at the time. I think I would have said that as well, or unprepared, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
I did propose to her, I mean, gender roles and stuff like that, sort of.
Yeah.
But I did feel pressure to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it really weird for me, thinking back. I mean, who was I? I was, at the time when I married, I was a second semester student of English language and literature and philosophy, right? So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I really didn't know what I was supposed to be doing with my life.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I just studying English, even the idea of studying English, where did that come from? Well, because I was good in English, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of my mom. So but yeah, I just kind of fell in love with particularly older literature, or more like fantasy and science fiction literature. I was reading a lot there, and philosophy. I already was into Christian intellectuals like C.S. Lewis from my early 20s, and now I was studying literature and philosophy. This really broadened my mind, I would say, particularly medieval philosophy. I think taught a very deep part of me something about God. It taught me what you can and cannot say about God, for mm-hmm. example. So this whole idea of negative theology or the Neoplatonists, the mystics and so on, where you have God as the ground of being, for example, which means that if God is the ground of being, God is existence, basically. So it doesn't make sense to ask a question about the existence of God, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like asking if the color blue is actually blue or something like that. It's mm-hmm. just totally it doesn't make sense. So, and if you think of God like that, not as some being or entity or somebody who's angry at me if I masturbate or whatever, but as the ground of being itself, come on, right?
Mm-hmm.
You end up in a very different place. I mean, probably took a few years, but I really began deconstructing. I would say today I wouldn't have called it that, but how did it begin? I think I read some Rob Bell, moved on to Peter Rollins, Rachel Held Evans, and others.
Mm-hmm.
It would still take a few years. I think I discovered podcasts in 2015 or so.
Everybody,
but that's when the ball really got rolling. Yeah,
yeah, we all did. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Deconstruction. So So I was outgrowing the small churches that I was a part of still. Mm-hmm. I guess my faith was just growing bigger and more inclusive mm-hmm. at the time. During my studies, I almost forgot. A big thing for me was moving on from C.S. Lewis to George MacDonald, mm-hmm. That Scottish fairy tale writer and preacher from the 19th century. C.S. Lewis once said that he learned everything from George MacDonald. So I just went back to George MacDonald. And boy, that really, reading George MacDonald's sermons, that really changed a lot for me as well. At the time, I was sometimes moderating church services at a small church, and I just snuck as many George MacDonald quotes, or even, I don't know, later on Richard Rohr quotes and stuff like that into what I was saying as possible. And yeah, the podcasts, then, of course, a big thing, Rob Bell, again, the Robcast, Science Mike, the Liturgists. I discovered the Enneagram then in 2016, so that mm-hmm. was a huge thing. For me, that really boosted my own development, I guess, in terms of understanding myself. In our early marriage, sex with my wife was good. Was literally the first sex ever, I guess. So, yeah, of course, it was great. We had our routines, but it was very, very vanilla, very routined, always basically doing the same, or playing the same role, basically, the whole time. I guess it was also very shame. Shameful, or I don't know. I felt shame over my own body still a lot at the time. For example, it took me years before I first went to a sauna. And a sauna, I don't know how it is in other countries, but in Germany, everyone's always naked at the sauna. Actually not allowed to wear any clothes. And I really love this kind of wellness and sauna and stuff, but I couldn't go there for so many years just because I knew I would be naked. And I just, I felt so much shame. We had kids. We had kids in 2013 and 2016, and this has been a big, huge trigger for my inner growth, I guess, as well. Confronting my own inner child, going to therapy as a result. So that's that.
Ooh, therapy's fabulous. I'm curious about, just because a lot of my listeners are not outside of America, and I think it's really important for people to hear the impact of purity culture, Americanism outside of the context that we're most familiar with. And so I know that my experiences being naked or nude in America was so far, it didn't really happen until I started to travel outside of America. And I realized that literally everybody else thinks that bodies are just bodies and it's kind of no big deal. Also, from my experience, I am a Black woman, and I'm a larger Black woman. I'm very curvy. And so being in white evangelical spaces, my body did not match what I saw. And so that created another many, many layers of shame for me, because I thought that my body was made wrong. So for me to go to places where everybody else was nude or naked, and I was like, wait a minute, but y'all have bodies too. Like, I remember going to my first sauna. It was in the States. It was a Korean one, and I cried because I was like, women have scars and hair and chub and wrinkles, and it was amazing. And nobody was shocked when I didn't have clothes on, and that changed me forever. And so every time I find a sauna outside of America, I'm like, oh, we gotta go. It's so great. So I'm curious, like, I hear in your story that there were so many things that were very German that you couldn't enjoy because of the evangelical side. like, you know, that you were stuck in the middle, kind of? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
Well, or
yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. Yeah. In a way, I've seeing two sides to everything, basically, makes it a little bit easier, I guess, because you can always think, well, I'm not really here, right? I'm not really like this. But the whole body image thing, yeah, that's also been a great experience for me, just feeling okay with people, I don't know, seeing stuff, and with me seeing other people. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I went to Germany several years ago, I think 2014, and I was still like, I gotta wear shorts over my bathing suit, and I was like, I gotta cover my boobs, and the Germans were like, but why? Like, everybody can see them through your shirt, like, it's no big deal. And I was like, well, I mean, I still have to cover them. But they're like, but you could just not do that. And they could not understand. And that's when I realized, I was like, maybe my programming is off. That this is just, So being in the secular society of Germany helped me to, it started the questioning for me of like, where my body issue, my body concerns came from. And it helped so much being around my German friends. So I'm grateful for your country. Yeah. I am. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good thing about a secular society. I mean, in a way, it's also a pluralistic society, because so you can just believe what you want to believe.
Yeah.
For sure. Which also means that you will have a lot of people of faith somewhere, even if they don't talk so much about it. And I guess differences will balance each other out a bit more.
Mm.
And you probably, in the long run, end up in a bit more of a healthy space with many, many issues than you do if the culture is so driven by some kind of an agenda. This is very particular for Germany, and I don't really think we should go there too much, but Germany had this very, very huge breakdown, basically, 70 or 80 years ago, where everyone had been following a very, very unhealthy agenda, as everybody knows from history books. And when that fell apart, I guess this is still the echo of that. This is, okay, we don't want to have any agenda. We don't want to,
that makes sense.
We don't even want a flag. We don't want anything here. Yeah. It's like, get away with that nationalism. Get it. Every few years you have a new like nationalist party or whatever, but everybody hates them basically. And they're like, no, go away. No place for that here. And that that makes it a little bit, maybe it makes it a bit more healthy.
Oh yes.
If you had this big, huge thing. It's for easy for me to say, of course, right? Yeah. I don't want to live. I wouldn't have wanted to be alive, of course, 80 years ago, but, for us today, I mean, that's one of the things that where we can say, well, at least there was this big, huge thing that taught us not to go in a certain place there, or not to go in. And that's what I see. That's one of the big problems I see with America right now, that it's just so invisible that particularly in the Trump era, where were things going? I mean, where are things heading, right? It's it's so unpredictable and so weird. And it there's so many extreme things all of a sudden that are surfacing here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And that just wouldn't happen in Germany.
Right.
It's almost like we learned a lesson. It sounds a bit.
I know. I'm glad you learned. Hopefully America will learn sooner than later. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Before we get on my soapbox on that one, because I could talk about this all day. Oh, my goodness. So you moved from early marriage to a household of five. And so I'm curious, like, what was that journey like as you were making the adjustments and experimenting and trying new things or figuring out what you like and did not like?
Yeah. Okay. So, the big change happened in 2018, which is, I think, also when you went to China.
It was, yes.
So, 2018, big year.
It was.
My wife and I, my wife, let's call her V, mm-hmm. V for Vendetta, I don't know. We'd deconstructed our faith pretty much. We had also deconstructed the more authoritative ways of dealing with kids that we had sort of ingrained in the way we were behaving. And we'd thought a lot about that and gone more into this sort of attachment-based parenting style, where it's more about real boundaries and less about punishments or something like that. Anyway, we were already deconstructing a lot of stuff in our own lives and in our own minds. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was on a Facebook group that had something to do with the Liturgists podcast that mm-hmm. Somebody asked, "Hey, so if you're deconstructing your faith, has anyone also deconstructed their monogamy?" And I read that and I was like, "Whoa, what's going on here? What's this?" and I just was very intrigued with rethinking this whole monogamy thing as well. I'd never come across the idea actually before 2018. So just to fill you in on some of the stuff that had happened, I'd already finished my PhD. I got a job. We bought a house. We moved to the place where I had my full-time job now. We had two kids. So basically the perfect little family. What could go wrong? What could happen? Mm. What could still happen? My wife, V, was falling in love with a new guy. And this had happened before. I guess it happens every few years too. Every normal human being, fall in love.
Yeah.
Up until then, whenever that had happened, it had always ended in frustration and drama. And of course, we stayed together and, but I was getting this idea of opening up our relationship theoretically, just from reading Facebook groups and discussions and articles and books, while V had a very practical reason. And so we kind of just merged those two things and talked about it. And it was very exciting. It was a very, very exciting time. She started dating him and fell deeper and deeper in love with him. And I had this experience of just literally letting her go to him. And of course, I was very insecure, but I found a way. I just told her she always needed to tell me that she wasn't going to leave me and that then it was fine. So she would be dating maybe once a week or so. She would be dating this other guy. And at the time, we only told a few select people about all of this. We didn't tell the kids. What else happened? At one point we had a casual foursome with a couple, which was a bit awkward. Actually, mm-hmm. It was at our house. The kids were sleeping, but every once in a while they would wake up, and so I'd have to just go over and and then come back after a few minutes when they were back asleep. That was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. This other couple, they introduced us to squirting and stuff like that.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What else happened? We got on OkCupid, on Joy Club, which is this German language thing, Germany based, I guess, casual dating app. I got on Field and Bumble, and I started going to the Poly regulars table in the city close to where we live. I don't think I should talk too much about these dating apps. It's just that's been very frustrating for me.
So frustrating. So bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What this did to us at the beginning. First of all, I think it felt really, really good. For us, because we were discovering so many new things. Maybe a bit unfortunate for me, V discovered her own preference for manly men, like masculine, tall, muscular, well-endowed men, which is a liberation, I guess. I mean, it revealed to her how trapped she probably had felt with me, sort of being stuck with only me for the rest of her life. At the same time, yeah, for my ego, probably not so good. Yeah. Anyway, I should go on. I have my notes here. What else did I want to say? My first poly girlfriend, that was in 2019, a very, very sweet person. I actually met her on a dating app, so it does work from time to time that you actually get to meet a person.
Imagine.
She is very, very kind. We're still friends. She is a mom of three kids, and she basically introduced me to actual BDSM stuff. Now, as a child, I'd already had these fantasies, I guess, of being tied up and dominated. And as a teen, then I, of course, was in the gothic subculture, and so there was this whole SM and fetish fashion surrounding me, and I really, really liked the look and all of it. And so now I finally could live out some of the things that were as old as my own sexuality, really, for the first time, which was a very, very cool experience. This first poly girlfriend of mine, she broke up with me after a few months. That was also a first time experience. Nobody had ever broken up with me before. I mean, I really only have this one very long relationship with V, and apart from a few teenage things that just kind of dissolved after a time, nobody had ever really broken up with me. And I've never, to this day, I've never broken up with a person. That's kind of fancy.
Yes. I remember I was talking to one of my parents, and because I don't talk about like my whole phase over here in China too much with folks, just because people's opinions, and not specifically my parents, but like just it just gets weird. And my first, I didn't even know it was an official breakup, was with Pillow Alarm Clock, and I talk about him on my podcast all the time because he like just.
I remember that name.
God bless him. So like I was talking with someone. I was like, that guy cost me at least $2,000 in therapy just because I was wrecked. Because and I didn't realize until many months later when my therapist was like, yeah, that was a breakup, and I was like, that was horrible. Like, this is so bad. And so I didn't have the skill set even to know how to process this, and it was rough. So I feel you with this one. For sure.
Yeah, that was rough. I also started going to therapy, not because of the breakup, I wouldn't say, but around the same time, things were getting a bit complicated for me. I felt triggered in the presence of my family. It's just a lot of it was a very stressful time. I tried out different things. I did. I went to a course called MBSR. I don't know if you. I probably know that in the States as well. Mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is this mixture of meditation and yoga and stuff like that. I went on a contemplation retreat at a monastery that we have here close by. Really, really cool. Started doing some yoga, but basically, yeah, I went to therapy, just dealing with my trauma. Some of the stuff that I said earlier about my childhood experiences, I probably couldn't formulate like that without that therapy. Plus, personal coaching with somebody who I also met on OkCupid. I'm just going to call her R. Hello, R, in case you're listening to
Hello,
this.
R. Hello.
She coaches people, couples, and it's just so great, so intuitive, so good. She had a grasp of our whole poly situation, and because she's poly herself, and so that was really, really cool talking to her, or that is still really, really cool. She's helped us as a polycule so much. So yeah, quick shout out to R.
Yes, art.
Then how should I go on? 2020, the COVID pandemic. The breakup was over. I had something else going on, which I think doesn't really come into my story, at this point, at least, into the relevant part of my story, what we're talking here. But just to mention it, I fell in love with a partnered monogamous woman in 2019. And that's not a good idea. I
Yeah,
know you
that's
can't, you
hard.
probably can't help it when it happens, but anybody out there who's poly, don't fall in love with a partnered monogamous person. It wreaks havoc on everybody. It was so tragic, so dramatic. It hurt everybody involved. I wouldn't know how to avoid that. I wouldn't know how to do anything differently today, to be honest, because the feelings were just so strong. And this person, she's so dear to me still. I have been trying to maintain a normal friendship with her, which is hard, nearly impossible, I guess. Yeah, that was just it. Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't expecting that at all. But yeah, as I said, that's just the thing of, keeping that person, or keeping the right distance to that person, I guess. Just to be able to sort of survive, to live and to, yeah, that's been a big thing. Anyway, then 2020, the pandemic hit, and another person, I'm just gonna call her C, was a colleague of mine, or is a colleague of mine. And she was quarantined because she'd been traveling abroad. She had to stay in her own little apartment for weeks when she got back. Was really at the beginning of COVID. So she was very, very touch starved. And we had been developing this friendship over some months. I don't really know how long. And I'd already told her about the whole poly thing. And we discovered that she basically also felt the same way about that. Having, why not, right? Having multiple relationships at the same time. We discovered many more parallels. So, like, she had a Christian phase, for example, earlier. And so, what happened was that she visited us as a family. So, she came over for a few days sometimes. And in this time, it was a very, very strange time anyway, right? So early 2020. At some point we embraced, at some point we kissed. We had no romantic feelings for each other at all, other than friendship. We had no feelings for each other, but still we decided to, we were talking about so many things, and so we just decided to have casual sex. And the idea of this whole consent thing at the time was just blowing my mind, because that's another thing that you get from purity culture. Nobody ever talks about consent and how important that is. But this idea that, wait a minute, she likes kissing, I like kissing, she would like to have sex, I would like, why don't we just do it, because we're not hurting anyone. It's, we don't need romantic feelings. We just want to fuck, basically. So why don't we just do it?
Just need some
So
friction.
yeah, and that, I was not expecting that really from everything I'd learned so far, even including polyamory. I wasn't expecting there to be this physical bodily connection with someone who I was friends with, basically. But it turned out to be so good. We are so compatible. She didn't even know. It sounds horrible, I know, compatible. But yeah, we are. She has a high libido. I have a high libido. She didn't know it at the time, but she is also really into BDSM. And also our favorite roles match so well. So she's a bit more dominant. I'm a bit more submissive. We got into so many great resources. So for example, the Pleasure Mechanics podcast, Betty Martin and her work with the Wheel of Consent. I don't know if you know that.
Wait, I have to write these down just a minute. Betty Martin.
Betty Martin, Dr. Betty Martin, the Wheel of Consent, such a great tool for I can't even phrase it in a good way. The Wheel of Consent. Just Google that. It's okay. So great. There's this thing that she has called the 3-minute game, where you have these four different roles that you can play. It has nothing to do with BDSM, by the way. It's just basically sex, embodied, relating to each other in an embodied way. It doesn't even have to be sexual. But there's this 3-minute game where first one person does something for the other based on their consent. So what would you like me to do? How would you like me to touch you? And the other person, and then that goes on for 3 minutes. And then the next question is, can I touch you this way? Would you allow me to touch you? So then I'm touching her for my sake, basically, for what I want to do. And then it's the other way around. She asks me, how do I want to be touching? So there's these four quadrants all together. And that's been an eye-opener as well, because I kind of learned that I had been stuck in one of the four quadrants in my other relationship with V for many, many years. It was always me doing this, and it was always her. It was giving and receiving. It was just very fixed, basically, in that relationship. And so this Wheel of Consent basically ensures that you have at least 12 minutes where you're switching roles intentionally, and where everybody gets to be touched, and everybody gets to say yes or no, or yes, please touch me that way, no, please don't touch me that way, or whatever. Anyway, so we learned so many things. That's just one tiny thing. We read books, The Ethical Slut, Polysecure by Jessica Fern is a very, very good book about attachment styles and how that relates to non-monogamy. Really good. We had a casual threesome with a guy. So we've been discovering so many things. And C is so great. She reads so many books. She actually read a whole book about threesomes before ever having one. So that's...
my we kind of girl. Very... Read, yes. I love yeah. it.
We, yeah. And it feels so safe. It feels so good. Like we want to know what we're doing before we do it, basically. Fast forward to 2022, I got her pregnant.
Whoa, this wasn't baby. Planned. Yeah. Yes. Congratulations. I know.
Yeah.
Wow. I love it. It started with brainy sex. And then now we have a little brainy baby.
Mm. Yes, yes, yes. And that little one will be arriving in, I don't know, a few days, a few weeks. It can't be longer than a few weeks now.
Oh, my gosh.
so maybe when this podcast appears, I'll be on baby leave, taking baby time.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and it's a daughter. Yay, finally a daughter.
Finally.
Finally.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I am so curious about what a poly family will look like. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, yes. And like, how are you, like the roles and who, what is that going to be looking like? And how are you navigating conversations as you're planning for this new one to come?
Yeah. Well, two phases. First, we came out to some people, more people than we initially intended. But our relationship was growing. I mean, C and me, our relationship was growing so tight, and it didn't make sense to call us, for us to call ourselves anything else but partners. So we started calling ourselves partners, and we started informing our colleagues. We were sharing a workspace. So we started out basically with the colleagues and the bosses, and everybody reacted in a very positive way to that. Which might be, I mean, of course, secular Germany, right? But it's also in academic, in this academic surrounding, I guess it's also much more okay to do outside of the box stuff. And now the baby is, that's the second phase. I would say the baby is forcing us to come out in many, many more ways to our families and friends and neighbors. So what we're doing is, we also hadn't planned this earlier, but this, I mean, financially, this is the only thing that really makes sense right now, is that C is moving in here at our house officially. So we have a new mailbox sign and everything with more names on it now. Yeah, this has been going on for a few weeks or months now. I mean, it's been very gradual for the last 2 years or so. She's been here maybe 50% of the time, and now it's close to 100% of the time, and she'll be really be giving up her other apartment very soon, and then she'll just be here. And yeah, I can't really say a whole lot about that yet. Whenever we watch Netflix together, the three grown-ups in the household, which is cool. We have my two females have a very good relationship with one another. They're friends, and that's very, very important to me, actually. If that were not the case, if they could, you know, if they couldn't connect, I don't know if that would work. We'd have many more problems, I think. The problems that we have are actually time is a big thing. And I guess that my wife, V, probably has the fear that I won't be around to just help her, or to do the regular stuff as much anymore. You know what I mean? So just like with the household and taking care of the two bigger kids, that's maybe one of the biggest issues right now. The relationship dynamic itself is, in our case, well, maybe also not so typical, because I have one very, very old relationship, my relationship with V. We've been married for over 20 years, and so of course that feels very, very different from a, I don't know, new relationship. So there's this natural, it's kind of like, I don't know, a very old tree versus a sapling or something like that. It's just, it's very, very different. The feeling that you get is just very different. We have our phases, I guess. Right now we're hardly ever intimate or anything like that. It's just, it feels very, very old. We're more like, I mean, I don't want to say this in a general way, but at times it feels more like brother and sister or something like that, sharing a space. So yeah, I guess I'm much closer to C right now than I am to V. But yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, of course. And the kids are there, right? The kids are processing things. My oldest son is now 9 years old, and he's asking questions, like, does every family have a C? Does every family have this other person that came in? So the diversity, or the differentness of this setup that we have here, is becoming a thing, of course, for the kids as well. And yeah, hopefully the baby will be born into an environment where non-monogamous setups are considered to be a bit more normal than they are right now. I mean, kids, but in general, kids don't have a problem. That's maybe one thing I should say. In general, because that's one of the things that people always ask. You didn't ask me this, but most people ask, but what about the kids? You know, will the kids be fine with, you know, with your relationship setup and with the situation? But Actually, it's the grown-ups around us that have the problems, because it's non-traditional, basically. And for kids, it's just you just explain it in the simplest way, in a way that they understand. Well, she's my friend too. I like her too. Yeah, okay. And they just accept that completely because they're not in this. Sorry, what?
They're perfectly fine and not bothered.
Yeah, they're not bothered by that because they haven't been in this culture for so long where we have mononormativity. It's kind of like heterosexual versus homosexual. If a kid grows up with two moms or two dads, of course that's the thing that's the most normal for them. And they don't have a problem with it. It's the other people that have problems.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, we came out to our families. Surprisingly, my own parents are really accepting of the whole situation.
Oh,
I wouldn't have thought this possible. But yeah, that's been surprising. And most people, I think, have been much more accepting than I would have initially thought.
I don't like to say what a happy ending, but I like how, like, you are just in the middle of your story, and I think that is so beautiful. About how you've shared, and I also noticed how one of the things that I pay my therapist a lot of money to help me understand is the idea that it's okay to change your mind and just be like, okay, well, this is what we're doing now. And it doesn't X out all of the history, but it's just like, we are in a new chapter. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. And so, I think, and the third thing that I noticed in this story and also in other folks that I've talked with that are polyamorous is like the need for communication amongst every person in order for this to work. Yes.
Communication is so key. I mean, it is in a mono relationship. Of course, communication is also very important. But yeah, just the fact that you have so many relationships, like if there's three people, you have four relationships basically going on, right? Because it's like between A, B, B, C, C, A, and then it's also the whole dynamic together. Mm. You have to count that one as well. And the number just gets higher and higher, sort of. So it's complicated, and you have to know, where am I going to be on Thursday night? Where am I going to, which bed am I sleeping in? Who has which expectation of me? And it has to be very, very clear, and you have to communicate. And that's a big, big, I don't want to sound like I'm mastering that at all. This is one of our biggest issues, I think, still figuring out who's going to be where. Does everybody know? Because you even with only three adult people, I tend to forget who knows what. Sometimes. So does V know that I wanted to spend the night at C's on Thursday or whatever? Did I just not tell her that for some reason? Did I just only provide it into our shared calendar but never really brought it up in person? And that can be a big, huge problem, actually, if you don't always communicate everything. Even the tiniest plans, like who buys what, and do we really need, I don't know, a new bed or all of that stuff. It can be so triggering. Also, sharing a space like this has its issues, of course. But yeah, I mean, we're all cool people that you can talk to. And that's, I think it requires a certain amount of maturity. I don't think you could do this with every grown-up person. It requires a lot of letting go of expectations and just being able to sit down and say, oh yeah, okay, so we're doing that differently now. Like you said, maybe we're in a new phase, or maybe we don't need to buy that table, or I don't know, something like that. Just change of plans all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think also
always in flux.
For sure. I've also noticed that this is my theory that I have done absolutely no research in whatsoever, and I've not read a book, but I'll say it anyway. I think that in listening to people's stories that are poly versus mono, if that's the word, there's like an assumption that mono people are not naturally good at communication, and therefore they don't have to do it. Whereas poly folks, in order for any sort of poly conglomeration or connection thing to exist, there has to be communication. Otherwise, it just completely explodes or implodes. And so my theory is that if mono people communicated as much as poly people did and had the same communication patterns and tendencies and practices, that mono relationships would be much stronger if that's what you choose. Whereas, I don't know. That's what I'm thinking. But I'm neither mono or poly, because like I'm just over here hoeing. So like I don't know how to answer this.
Yeah, I guess a big thing in monogamous relationships, or a big blind spot, is codependency. So you tend to just become codependent and rely on the fact that the other person is going to do this or say this if I say that or do this. Automatically, you just fall into these automatic things. And so I've had both, right? I've had monogamy for the longest time, and now I have non-monogamy, so I can directly compare. And what we've been deconstructing, I think, is also this, or what we still have to maybe have yet to deconstruct, are these automatic things. We think that the person is going to do that, and so they're probably going to do that, but oh no, they don't. So now all of a sudden, so it's not just communication versus non-communication, it's also, I guess, having expectations. So that's a big thing in monogamy, I think, that we have these unspoken expectations, as you said, of what's going to happen and how the person is going to act. And in poly, that becomes complicated simply because people are so different from one another. And anything can happen, really, in a dynamic. You get the whole dynamic coming into play then. I mean, the 3, 4, 5 people together are a completely new dynamic again. And so, yeah, there's a lot of negotiation. And so it doesn't work. I think you're right. It doesn't work without a more or less individualistic, consent-based approach to life. Like, I'm here. I'm owning my shit. I'm going to do it this way. If you want to join me, good. If not, then let's talk about it. How can we negotiate that it also works for you? And those are the kinds of conversations that you need. Whereas in monogamy, of course, you need them too. But you're a bit more blind to that, I guess. The danger of becoming codependent is just, and without anyone noticing, is just there. And that certain things just don't get talked about so much. And then, yeah, we just do it that way somehow.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I am so grateful for your story and your reflections and things. It's been fascinating to hear from you and the German side and the American side and all the things put together in a smoothie.
Yeah.
Yes. Before we close today, is there anything that like you forgot to say that you want to say, or like you think that this is really important and so you want to say it again just to make sure everybody hears it, or do you feel like, oh, nope, I'm good. I got everything out that I need to say.
No, I'm good.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Yes.
Yeah, for me too. Thank you for inviting me here on your show.
Wonderful. Thank you, Patrick, for sharing your story with us today. I'm always amazed when people like talk about their views and such, and all of these intimate details with random strangers. But in some way, it's pretty liberating, I think. I am also thrilled that you are in the process of bringing to this earth side another spirit and another human being. And I wish you all the best in the continued partnerships and also fatherhood that you are engaged in right now. I'm so thrilled for you and your family. For those of you who are listening, please support and find and befriend Patrick. You can find him at secure.not.pure, and that is secure_not_pure. Also, follow and support my work. Tell people about the podcast that I do, my Instagram page, and all of my little shenanigans and such. And also, come be a guest on the podcast. Inbox me at Holy Coitus, and that's HEAUXLYCOITUS. So many people have asked me, like, do I have to, like, have all of these salacious stories? Absolutely not. In order to be a guest, all you have to do is have a body and some opinions that you want to talk about. That's literally all. Until next time, be kind to yourself, have lots of orgasms or none at all, if that's what you choose to do. And also drink water, take a nap, and apologize for none of the above. Take care, y'all. Bye-bye.